recording. There we go. And I figure it would be good to maybe just start like introductions to just kind of let everyone know who everyone is, what they do. So I'll start. I'm Tiffany. Hey, y'all. I'm a curator at the Birchfield Penny, a photographer, and a current visual studies student at UB. And I'm going to pass it to Rashad, who is to my left.
What's up, y'all? I'm Rashad. I am a I'll say I'm a teaching artist. My medium is fashion, particularly apparel design. But I do work in styling and fashion photography as well. I've been a teaching artist for about 6 years, and I'm in the process of developing my own design studio. Which will function as a lab, a creative space, and a incubator for fashion, art, and photography. I'll pass it to Tony Boy, who's next to me.
All right, guys, Bryant Tony, as Rashad called me, Tony Boy. I am a sound engineer. I've studied sound at Full Sail University. I've been in the Buffalo hip hop scene for about 11, 12 years, along with Rashad. And I like to teach, you know, people about hip hop culture. That's one of my main focuses.
Yeah. You can pass along to whoever you want to go next.
I'll pass it on to Jason.
Hey everyone, my name is Jason. I'm the acting director of Dope Collective, which stands for Dismantling Oppressive Patterns for Empowerment. I'm also a community educator. I guess I've been involved with the art space for the last 6 years. Before that, I just, you know, on Sam here did kind of just levels of organizing without realizing that that was considered, but I was going to be considered an organizer. I've always been like involved in community projects throughout my life, just different community organizations. Other than that, I'm just here kind of like, I like what we do with Dope because we try to bridge different parts of the culture together. So we make sure we create more like inclusive and harmonious spaces amongst artists, especially specifically artists of color, but have different intersections beyond just race and ethnicity, but also rather differently able, rather than identified as LGBTQ, but creating an actual inclusionary space where everyone feels welcome, they can be their authentic selves. And I always feel like cultivating those spaces are important because it allows people to be comfortable with each other, to be honest.
And I'm Julia. I'm a visual artist here in Buffalo, New York. I focus mostly on figurative work and portrait work. I also do mural work here, and I'm a teaching artist as well.
And Don, I see you here. Are you, can you hear us? Are you able to unmute or let us know you're here with us?
Yes, I'm here with you. I am just casually listening in, if that's okay. I'm a jazz presenter here in Buffalo and just interested in this conversation. So I'm here. Thank you.
Wonderful. So before we dive into it, because I will forget otherwise, I do want to just take a quick screenshot of us, just for, you know, for documentation. So if you all could just give me your best smile, I'll take a quick couple of screenshots. Say cheese. And I'll do one more. Okay. So I don't want to be the one to start the conversation at all. So I would love to pass it along to anyone that has a prompt that they're particularly interested in kind of jumping off the conversation with, or one that, you know, kind of you gravitated towards that was of interest to you. So the floor is open.
I got one. I'm sorry. My mouth was, I thought, you know, right? But like the fourth one in says, what do you think about the professionalization of art practices? And I think that that's interesting because working as a teaching artist, I think that I've I've become less inclined to present myself in a certain way. Mm-hmm. I think like if I have like interviews, I'm comfortable showing up in sweats, in a hoodie. A couple of y'all may know that I got my head tattooed. Like I've started really paying attention to how I show up and really showing up as myself no matter what. Mm. And I think artists kind of like spearhead that movement of us like destigmatizing the come as you are in relationship to being professional and like reshaping the whole perspective on being professional. Mm-hmm. So that card particularly stuck out to me as I started to scroll through. What do you guys think?
I've always played being professional off of, you know, being on time. It doesn't matter like how you look, how you dress, whatever. If you come in and you're working, your work is efficient with what, you know, what you are, then I don't really care like how your appearance is, you know, should I say. Mm-hmm. That's always been one of my standards.
Yeah, I think for me, it's very interesting, like coming into the Birchfield and like evolving into this space of like moving from, you know, the front desk where, you know, I didn't really give much thought to how I looked in terms of like, you know, I would just wear whatever, keep it a certain level of business casual, but, you know, not really worrying or being concerned, like if I have my hair wrapped or if I wear something pro black or whatever. But then moving into like a curatorial space and, you know, being more in the administrative side, I definitely have seen myself be more conscious of like how I present myself, but wanting to like use that space to come, like you're saying, Rashad, exactly like as I am. And it's so interesting because I never really gave it much of a conscious thought. But I remember there was there during shelter in place where we were working remotely, like I would wear my head wraps a lot because I wasn't doing my hair to get on camera or whatever. And Renata, your mom, Brian, she was like just saying how empowering that was to see me like as a young Black person just being unafraid of like wearing, you know, like a head wrap or wearing something that's very like pro-Black. Like I'll come in like with the Black Women Inspire Me t-shirt or just like not being afraid of, you know, the respectability and how that was empowering for her to feel like she can come into that space and do the same thing. And I think like seeing that, you know, be normalized in that space, especially in like an arts and cultural space, like I think that's so important. And that's why I try to like be a representation of that, you know, in the small way that I can, you know, being in the public eye, like I'll wrap my hair up any day, I don't care. And I like for people to be able to see that and not take it as a certain, like, you know, as me being any less professional, I'd say.
I'd like to bounce off of that. It's shifting the idea of what professional is and isn't for the better, I think. You know, it shouldn't be considered unprofessional to do protective styles or to wear your hair natural or to wear a wrap. That's all professional as well. I think it's just we're finally able to transition into a point in time where people understand that. So.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm curious, like, what you guys think, like, in the terms of, like, art production, right, and presentation, there's also this, like, I'm curious what your thought is around, like, this idea or standard around what it means to be a professional artist. Like, how do you come into a space showing that you're, you know, prepared to have your work displayed to industry standards, or, you know, you've gotten your, you know, you've got your hardware on the back of your canvas, for instance. Like, what has the experience been with, like, the expectation of knowledge about, like, what a professional artist, you know, how they're supposed to, I guess, come into, you know, a space for exhibition or for presentation? Like, what has that experience been like? I mean, maybe Julia, that's like more directed towards you, but I'm just curious like what that's been like.
Well, I think I'm still learning when it comes to what the best practice is for presenting in a studio space, because to me, I think, well, however you bring the work, as long as it's hangable and it's what your vision was, to me, that's fine and presentable. I think where I encounter it more is in my mural work. So I'll meet with a lot of clients that are non-artists. And I think when I go for those meetings, you know, a lot of times it's people that are developers or, you know, investors and stuff like that. and they don't really understand necessarily that an artist could just dress however, and I'm still going to perform at a level that they expect. So I find that I'll dress up for those meetings, and I'll come, like you were saying, come on time and just make sure that I'm prepared with like all of my layouts and my mock-ups, and that everything looks really polished. That way, you know, they know that I'm professional.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's important. But I also like, because I see how like sometimes like if you're like for students going through like MFA programs or just like kind of starting out, there's this like gap where, you know, you might not necessarily be learning all the ins and outs of what the industry constitutes as a professional or polished presentation. But then when you come into that space, there's this expectation that you kind of already know. Or if you're like a self-taught artist and you're not in that formal sort of space to kind of have that insight, there's this expectation that you just know how, you know, you're supposed to hang to professional standards or whatever. And I see that there's this like this gap where, you know, where are you supposed to find that knowledge if you've never, you know, if this is your first exhibition, like how do you learn, you know, for next time to just embed that into your process and your practice, you know, as you get more exhibition exposure. And for me, I always like to take the opportunity, like if I'm working with an artist that, you know, this is their first exhibition, I like to like bring like our preparator to give advice about like, okay, so this is what you can think about in terms of like frames or, you know, the best way to hang, and just like making those spaces for education and like sharing of knowledge without the stigma of, you know, you don't know what you're doing. You're not a professional artist because you haven't learned. I think that's so important because there's no real way, like real concentrated space to learn a lot of those like small logistical sort of details, but it is important to know like for your own presentation and when you're going into spaces and working with institutions that kind of expect you to have that knowledge already.
I feel like that kind of draws the line between professionalism and actual experience. Mm-hmm. You have experientials, like you have everything that they need, but it's not presented the way that, in a way that they feel like it's marketable. It dismisses you from the conversation. And I think it's frustrating for a lot of people, and I guess in like a lot of fields or markets where the labor you produce can be really determined by the market, rather your artist, educator, promoter, what have you. And it is just kind of like, there's people that sometimes show like their body of work in their most authentic way possible without professionalism, and they get the job position, they get signed, whatever. But it's like, as far as the weeding process, they want to go for the person. It's like, can you prove it? Versus it's like, I have lots of proof, but it's like, no, what are the numbers, which are important? But on the scene, it's like, sometimes people are afraid to take the loan and just experiment with the person, just see like rather they have like the professionalism or not from your standard, they know what they're doing. Right. You know that they know what they're doing. And a lot of times, no one tends to use a lot of people who put their labor on the market that way. You know, they don't really see the value in what's done because it's not done in the professional standard. Right. But they still see your potential, but they can't trust potential, even though your potential might just be success.
I definitely had to deal with that in the audio world. Being a young Black man in an industry where most of the guys are probably in their 50s, 60 years old, because, you know, people stay in that industry for a long time. So I had to work my way up and like be on time and be professional and, you know, work my way through the ranks to get, you know, to where I am today.
And I think there's like this like evolution of like what constitutes like professional, which I think is starting to become a little bit more sort of like fluid in terms of like what you're saying, Jason, like this idea of like having the potential versus like the experience, but then also like this idea of like just exercising like mutual respect almost, you know, like I'm gonna come on time because I respect your time. And it is also professional, but if I come on time and I'm like dressed down and, you know, I'm not with the polished like briefcase, that doesn't minimize, you know, who I am as a professional that I'm coming to the table. But I am showing that that respect for your time, what we're doing, you know, the craft is all still there. Ooh, okay, so I found a question that I think might be interesting. Discuss factors that contribute to the changing cultural landscape here and how have they affected your practice? That's,
The changing cultural landscape has, in a way, taken away from a lot of performing artists musically. We do not have venues. And the few venues that do house, you know, music, that they only take in like rock bands, or, you know, white bands or whatever, how to say it. There's only, I think, Je ne sais quoi. That's one of the places that they play a few black bands. I remember DBGB's used to have neo soul nights on Sundays. There was a lot of places where we could perform. And now it seemed like it just kind of fizzled out.
Why do you think that is? Like, what do you think contributed to that?
A lot of the, like, they just changed the landscape of how a lot of those places where bars are. So, like, Allen, Chippewa changed. The noise ordinance is a lot of places, a lot of venues, it all changed. And now the residential area, some of them now.
I think part of it too is, particularly with that kind of thing with music, there is a desire on Allen in particular to have black music, but not black people in the place. Mm-hmm. I feel that like with certain hip hop events that we have and stuff like karaoke and things like that, you know, you go in there and the crowd is pretty homogenized, but.
I feel like that's like an everywhere thing. I think, you know, the desire is to always enjoy black culture, but not welcome, you know, not welcome us overall, like, or limit us, or put a ceiling or a cap on, you know, how much we get to take advantage of things, especially like the equity part. Like, I always talk about equity and like all of these discussions, like, we are the last ones to get any type of equity in like anything that is, you know, is the benefits of our culture. So that's like I think that's a universal thing. It crosses over all of our mediums, you know, in spaces beyond art even. I think that's just ingrained into the identity of America in general.
I'm curious what you guys think about, like, so we're seeing now, like, with, you know, this reckoning that America is going through, and I use that like very pointedly because nothing is really changing, but like how that has like led to this like newfound like interest or I guess promotion of black art, right? Black artists, it's very much in trend right now. It's very hot in, you know, the art market, and like you're saying, Rashad, like across culture overall, but it doesn't seem like that is opening doors to like real ownership or agency. But
you know what's crazy, you say that, sorry to cut you off.
No, please go.
There's two parts of this. The first thing is, I was really thinking about this when I was talking to Mr. Ott last time, but you know how like it's super trendy for like people to visit museums, visit galleries, and post and do all of that. I'm thinking about how that's gonna look inside the Albright when it opens back up, and like how like social media users are gonna be active within that space. I'm very interested in seeing how that goes, because I feel like that's gonna be a thing, right? But I'm also noticing so many different galleries opening up in Buffalo. Like, I literally see a new one like every 2 or 3 weeks, like getting worked on or whatever, right? And I know they're white, but it's just gonna, I think it's gonna be interesting seeing, like, you know, like once they're open and like once they're active, like what is going on inside them. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I, you know, I'm not like I don't have my hand in like the art scene like you guys probably do, but like I'm seeing gallery after gallery after gallery. And mind you, so many of them close, but now it's like there's new ones all the time. So I'm really interested in regards to seeing like what art's going in these places, who's going to be in these places, how are they going to be presented, and all of that. I'm super interested. If y'all know anything, like let me know, because like I went to what's that? There's a coffee shop downtown, right next to the library, Public or something like that.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
I went in there, and pardon my French, that shit was just white as fuck. It was white, and I was like, yo, I don't think I could come back here. Like, it's too white, but it's super nice, but it's just too white, right? And across the street, there's going to be a gallery. There's a gallery getting worked up. So I'm like, yo, I don't know. Because I'm, you know, I'm into all of that stuff, but.
It's funny, that coffee shop used to be Black owned too.
Word?
Really?
It used to, my dad's friend Will, the Empty Cup, that was their second location for a while.
Wow. But,
yeah.
No, not that corner. Not that corner. Okay. No, it's the Hotel Lafayette.
Okay.
It's on that corner. So and then there's a gallery getting opened up on the opposite corner that's getting worked on.
Okay.
I know they're not giving that to us. I mean, are there any more Black galleries? There's one that was on May?
On Hurdle, Princessa. Is that's her name. I can't remember her last name, but she,
Williams.
Yes. She opened that on Hurdle, I think maybe like last year. In terms of other galleries, that's the only Black one that but it's like even for me, so like working as a curator, like, you know, there's been so much like, and I swear, like, I hate it, like, so much attention around, you know, oh, first Black curator at the Birchfield Penny, like, I think maybe, like, the only Black curator in Buffalo right now, and, like, for me, that feels like such an insane amount of pressure, you know, to be, like, the only one, and, like, the attention around that, for me, the more important question is, where is the space for all the other Black curators that are coming or are interested in, you know, moving into that pipeline? Like, where is the room for all that? Like, why am I the only one right now? Like, can we talk about that side of the conversation? And to your point, like, with all of these, like, galleries and new spaces, like, Buffalo's definitely becoming, like, a major, and it has been forever, but I feel like people are finally, like, kind of starting to see how Buffalo really is a prominent hub for art and for culture. And it's like, okay, so since we are now getting on the same page about that, where's the representation, not just in artists, but in, you know, ownership, in curators, in art educators, in art critics, right? Like, there are all of these different facets that contribute to the ecosystem of the arts, and that diversity is still not quite where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. I love that that's your mindset too, because I feel like so many people are just concerned with securing their spot in whatever that area is. And then it's like, okay, there's only room for just me, and right, they protect it and like guard it. And then, you know, don't try to make room for other people. So I think that's great that you're already in that mindset, because there is room. There's plenty of room.
And there's plenty, like, there's so much history, so much talent here that, like, for me, I could never like do justice as the only one to tell all of those stories anyway. So first of all, that's a lot of work, and that's a lot of pressure, and that is very limiting because it's all coming from one perspective. And I don't speak for all Black people, like, none of us do. So why would I feel entitled to be that gatekeeper, you know, for my community? It just doesn't make sense to me.
I think it has to do with what institutions people acknowledge. Like, I feel like for a lot of the work we all do, whenever we create the space we create for our artists, we're technically engaging in curation. Rather, my members in the collective have done like an art show based around whatever subject, from Black femininity to I don't talk about legalization of marijuana, but it was an art show. It's like we curated an art show. But because the Birchfield Penny is like a major art institution in Buffalo, it's just like, this is the one Black curator who's probably actually from a larger network of people who curate arts culture within Black culture within Buffalo, New York, or just even in the culture of Buffalo in general, what people actually determine as the institution, or yet again, we're talking about professionalism. It's like a lot of people end up in those institutions because they came from the spaces that a lot of us have helped curate and created with just whoever we were in community with whatever given moment. And it's great that you're in that position, but it's just like the fact that you said to have you here and you see all of what's going on within Buffalo as far as Black creators and Black organizers, what have you, you're noticing the actual disproportion that comes with who they're letting into these spaces.
I think also to jump off of that a little bit, I think we have to demand with institutions that it's not enough for them to just check a diversity box and say, oh, well, we have our one Black, you know, curator, artist, performer, whatever it is, and say that's not enough, you know. And I think so often with groups, you see that be the case. They're like, oh, well, I guess we're done. I've literally heard somebody say something along those lines before. It was like, well, they had added some new people to the roster. Like, well, we have a Black male and we have this and that. And it's like, you just check off boxes.
Right. That's insane. But actually, so that segues into another hot topic, I guess, from the cards, which is number 8, which is white gatekeepers for Black cultural producers. So I'm curious what your experiences have been with that, or your thoughts, or, you know, critiques of, you know, how that transpires here locally.
I can get very touchy here. You see how Rashad's face is getting.
I know, I see it.
It can get kind of touchy here. But, I mean, in almost any art industry, like we just said, like we don't have any ownership of our galleries. We don't, so like we have to work with these people. We have to deal with these people to a certain extent without, you know, selling yourself out. Mm-hmm. So it's always a battle trying to find a balance of, you know, not being taken advantage of.
I think sometimes going with that is also the fact that we live in like a white supremacist culture as it is. You're always going to have to deal with white people. But then sometimes people get caught up with actually networking and using it to actually build your own infrastructure while working with another institution. People have this need to center the institution that's actually creating all these boundaries for you having to work with them. And people center like so much of, what are they doing? Like, if we don't do it this way, and we're not respectful enough, we're gonna fuck it up, and we're gonna lose everything. It's just kind of like, well, what about your rainy day fund, which is the communities you're investing in? You're actually investing on communities. Like, once we get cut off, we get cut off, but we hopefully be invested enough into our own institutions that we'll be self-sufficient that we don't have to actually care about working with them, because they're gonna end up wanting our resources anyway, which is the reason why they have us in this gridlock with them. So once they get rid of us and we're good enough, especially good enough for us, we have the room to do better. And they're basically going to be like, hey, we've seen that you did this new thing, like they always do. How can we use this? And it's just kind of like, well, talk to this guy. It's like, there's that fear of being, it's that fear of actually allowing the people exploiting you to actually determine your wealth and like finding that balance or actually understanding what it is to know your work, especially within the industry or in the Black world, where being Black, you are always told to question your work. That's pretty hard.
I think the way that I've been trying to combat it is by always like searching for some type of equity in all of the deals that I'm making, all the contracts that I'm getting. So over the last year, I started writing supplies budgets into my actual contract so that I get to dictate, well, so that I get an extra little whatever, and then I get to dictate what happens with my supplies afterwards. So I can either give them to students as a way for them to actually break into whatever I'm teaching them. Like I gave away sewing machines, or whatever tools or whatever supplies for dedicated young people who are, you know, really considering growing in the area, as opposed to leaving them out of sight and they sit around for 2 years. I had a contract from last summer, a sewing workshop, and they bought like 10 sewing machines. I didn't get a contract for a year after that. And all of the tools and supplies are just sitting in a room. Like, for what? I could have either took them with me and had them accessible for other workshops that I'm doing, or we could have just gave them to the students and seen what they could have come up with, you know? So I took the step of actually, you know, like, no more supplies budgets, write all of that money into my contract. I'll figure out what we're doing with this stuff afterwards. I actually got turned down for a contract for that particular reason, speaking to this white gatekeeper thing, right? Because I'm taking that shift, I know that there are some people that are going to tell me no. They have told me no, but that, you know, that's what happens. You know what I'm saying? But we've got to continue to take those steps ourselves and bet on ourselves, I think, sometimes sacrificing whatever. But that's definitely happened to me more times than I can think of. But, you know, something we probably are all combating continuously.
It's kind of like you're always looking at either I feel like from a lot when I hear these people are between strategy and integration. You want to work with these people so they know that they mean well, but then you still notice that they're still operating from a place of privilege and confirmation bias from whatever they experience. Like, I've dealt with that with like certain shows that me and my members wanted to do with dope, with being groups of people not knowing why we want a large artist budget for a festival. But the people who are giving the budget are benefiting from putting us on, like, by saying that they donated to this festival that we're doing. And they're so busy trying to control it because they see it's a success for all the people we can bring out or all the organizations can bring together. But they still are afraid that if we do it their way, it's going to do whatever the fuck. They can't control whatever we're going to do. But you benefited from the thing you cannot control. And it's the thing is like, when you start noticing it's like they want to control more, that's when it's just like, now you have to negotiate. Now it's just like, now you have to strategize. You can't open this up to the community in a way of like building bridges for everybody, because like they're trying to control the total.
I think that like lends itself to, you know, the need to have conversations about what it means to really be an ally, right? And like, how do you show that you are, you know, in utilizing your privilege to support and to be a true ally versus a performative sort of approach where it's like you want, you know, the accolades of supporting the community or, you know, amplifying these Black artists, but not necessarily doing the work of understanding that that means taking a back seat and allowing, you know, the artists to have their own agency, right? To dictate how they see their production going forward or how they would like for something to be done. And I think when, you know, people who have this vision of allyship that is more performative are challenged, like Rashad, like how you've challenged this idea of no, like, this is what I need to happen with my supplies. Like, that's where you kind of, it kind of becomes clear like who really is an ally for what the mission is, for what it is that you're doing, and who just wants to, you know, give that impression, but still have control over, you know, the puppet strings.
I feel like I saw a lot of that last summer, like a lot of people requesting Black Lives Matter murals and, you know, the things surrounding that, work surrounding that, only to see now just kind of like all of that fall off and people not really being interested in doing anything beyond that. Like, somebody wanted to tack up a mural and then just be done with it. And I mean, I don't know, on the note of like white gatekeeping, I think it's a reality. And most in fine arts, at least with visual arts, most institutions are run by white people. And I think, yeah, if it's performative, you're gonna learn very quickly that it's performative. And sometimes it's just about like being willing to walk away from that and say, well, I'll pass up on this versus compromise.
Mm-hmm. think I'm done compromising at this point.
Gotta draw a line in the sand. Have to draw a line in the sand.
To discuss gentrification and its effect on local arts communities. Are all of us, well, Tiffany, you're not from Buffalo, but is everybody else from Buffalo?
Some kids have a very clear line here in Buffalo.
How have you seen like that divide? Like I came here and just, you know, learned about the Main Street divide very early, but I'm curious, like for all of you that are from here and have lived here your whole lives, like how have you seen that change or not change at all, you know, over the course of your lives here?
Well, I grew up near, you know where the medical, do you know what the medical corridor is?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fruit Belt? Okay, so I grew up over there.
Okay.
My neighborhood's gone. You know, I grew up around the corner from the Langston Hughes. Right. I was at the African Culture Center all the time, all of that. But at, you know, at the same time, like I went to church across the street from where the Freedom Wall is, you know, so it's kind of, I think we were talking about gentrification earlier. It's kind of like, it's like a both ends as far as like our community is concerned. It's very complex and there's a lot of depth to it. Of course it's ugly. But you know, now we're talking about it. Now, since we're forced to see it, but now we're talking about it. You know what I'm saying? So it's interesting. It's interesting.
I think in Buffalo, gentrification is like, it's weird how I want to word it, but like they take all this money and, you know, they start in North Buffalo, then they go downtown and there's supposed to be a big budget for Bailey. And they started Bailey, did, you know, some stupid indentations on the side of the streets or whatever, and then they stopped. And then Bailey is still Bailey, like, but everywhere else is getting, you know, all types of restaurants and, you know, businesses. But, you know, they still treat the east side and the west side, you know, like nothing.
And even like we were talking about like this, like growth of, you know, arts communities and you know, just the growth of the art and cultural scene here. And, you know, I'm thinking about like, what about like the Michigan Street Heritage Quarter? Like I've heard, and like just through my research working on Langston Hughes, because I haven't been here, but just like seeing that there have been so many like stops and starts with really turning that into a cultural hub for African-American history and culture and the significance that it has here in Buffalo. And it seems like it starts and then it stops. It starts and then it stops, and you know, it remains unchanged. But then, like you were saying earlier, Rashad, like all of these other galleries and cultural spaces are able to, you know, emerge and flourish. But then you have these Black spaces that are not.
I think my mom has been working on the Michigan Street Preservation for most of my adult life. I'm 32.
Wow.
So, you know, like you said, the starts and stops, like for them to just put up like a banner, like, I don't know, like I felt kind of, I was upset about that. Like, it was like, if you're going to do all that work just for them to put up a banner, like actually put like, then they put a Tim Hortons there.
I heard, yeah, that was like highly contentious, right? Because it was just like this, you know, this chain restaurant, you know, that had nothing to do with the cultural significance of the area.
So, yeah, it's it feels like as soon as we get there, they kick us back down a few steps.
Well, I think the money is invested where they feel like and when they feel like, and then taken away, you know, when I laugh because I think about the Broadway Market. I was born on Sweet Avenue, like right off of there. And it makes me laugh so much to see like Easter time. It's this very like okay thing for everybody from the suburbs to come out and be there, which is great. But then it's like, what about the rest of the year? Like, you know, it just goes to, you know, waste because they don't do any investment in really like building that up.
Mm-hmm. And it just sits there. Like, I, like, this might be a little touchy, but this whole thing with Langston Hughes, like, I've been, like, so consumed into it, you know, for work and for research or whatever, but just seeing, like, all, everything that went down with it, and, you know, for it to still just be sitting there empty with nothing, like, for me, it's like, what was the point of, you know, everything that contributed to it not being used as the Langston Hughes Institute anymore, for it to literally just sit there?
I mean, that's why I really commend Lindsay for using the terminal last year, you know, for bringing it back into the city and, you know, trying to uplift that area. Yeah. So, I mean, if we can have more events like that would be beautiful. Or, like, even have people open up businesses back on that side to where we don't have to keep going to, you know, North Buffalo, Kenmore, whatever.
How do y'all feel about Elmwood Village?
What is there to feel about it?
Okay, so, you know, we went to school over there. You worked there. Now you work there. You know, so how do y'all feel? I'm interested in knowing, because I have my own sentiments, but I want to hear, you know, how do y'all feel about it?
Regular fake woke art shit. It's just like, you know, everything else, but just on the white liberal art side. We love BLM because it's trendy. I never really had any real feels. I knew what it was. I just always, if I had any feels, it's yet again about centering whiteness and dealing with a lot of people of color that centers Elmwood Village as like this hub of culture and art and intellect. Like you just mentioned, the Langston Hughes Center, the African Culture Center. There's a lot of people who will center this of like all this power in regards to the art world or whatever. And it's just like Buffalo's a lot bigger. And those of us who either are attached to different organizations, rather be the Juneteenth Coalition, rather it is like the African Cultural Center, is like the introduction to arts in Buffalo is very different. And like their cultural spheres are different versus in that space. It's just like we're consuming more shit so we can assess more power and have more control. My problem is when people center spaces like Elmwood, especially people of color, as that space, is like people end up becoming really self-sacrificing. It's not operating as a community, but operating as a sphere of not being allowed into the space where you can assess power. Elmwood is Elmwood.
And I think it goes back to your point that you made earlier, Jason, about like there being like specific institutions or hubs that are, you know, given the impression of being the most like the gold standard, the reputable, you know, these are the institutions. And it's like that allows like all of the other cultural hubs that exist and all the other spaces where these things are happening to kind of be overshadowed by this impression that, you know, the arts and culture scene in Buffalo is Albright, Birchfield, you know, and that's it. And there's so many other hubs, and not even just in a traditional like institutional sense, but you've got these organizations that move across different spaces and may not be in one central location, but, you know, bring these different facets of Buffalo's Black culture to these different hubs, and yet that becomes overshadowed by these institutions.
Exactly, yeah.
So I guess the question I have, I'm curious, kind of like dovetailing off of that, like, what would you guys like to see more of from these big institutions? And I know it's weird because like I'm Birchfield, but also I'm Black and I'm like, you know, for the culture too. So I like navigate this very interesting sort of space, but I'm just curious, like, what does doing the work look like in your mind for these institutions?
Inclusion. More Black faces, more people that look like us, so that you know, not to say that it makes sense, but it's, we can actually pinpoint and do the things that we need to do to uplift everybody.
with inclusion actually giving us the spaces we need. Sometimes spaces, well, not sometimes, actual spaces without them, actual spaces for me to talk about them and understand inclusion comes in multiple ways of looking at our multifaceted identities and also looking at other organizations similar to what they want to include to actually help build out that network where things aren't also being exploited, but we can actually both benefit without exploiting anyone.
Right.
I think with inclusion, I want to see accessibility, like an awareness of that. You can put on all the shows you want that include Black art, but if it's not being advertised, you know, in the Challenger, it's not being promoted, you know, in Black spaces, nobody's going to know. And if all of those spaces are centered in Elmwood or, you know, areas where people don't always come to or don't feel welcome, then it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. I think that's where I would make my point too, is the accessibility. Yeah. I think that, you know, especially in the age of where art is so popular, you know, the Birchfield's still open. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know there was tons of kids in my program that had never stepped foot in the Birchfield. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But loved art, or, you know, I want to go see some art. How come this right across the street? How come you never go there? It's because, I don't know. Like, you know, what's the reason there? And I think there has to be some type of investment into that, because that's not necessarily the consumer's responsibility. It's the responsibility of the institution to know why, you know, why are these kids not coming here? Why is it not interesting to them? Why is the community not, you know, investing, making some type of investment into this, whether it just be their time, whether it be whatever, you know? I think that accessibility is probably the most important thing that I would think of too.
And for opportunity too, like, one of the things that I'm like really excited about working on right now. So I'm working on an exhibition that I'm curating with Leroy Johnson. It's a retrospective that's opening in November. And we're doing this educational collaboration. We're working with students from BPS and Squeaky Wheel and BCAT and all these other spaces to get them involved with Leroy's work and to create their own work in response that's going to be included in the show as well. And just like rethinking this idea of access and transforming it from being this reactionary thing where it's like you know, come in and we bring you in and you see art, but what it is that you're looking at has already sort of been determined, and whether or not you see yourself reflected is, you know, it just is what it is. And like, I like how this sort of approach is like transforming that, where it's like, no, you're having a stake in forming the exhibition, you're involved in the process and developing the meaning that is coming, you know, from the themes in the show, and you're literally reflecting yourself into the exhibition because your work is included as well. And I think that's a very important sort of avenue of access as well. And, you know, having it be this like proactive engagement as opposed to, you know, okay, we just want people through the door. Like, I'm really interested in like, how do you cultivate those deeper in more enriching sort of spaces of engagement where you're not just seeing yourself, but you're also being activated to be a participant in shaping, you know, what is being reflected in the space as well too. So yeah, I think that access, the accessibility factor is so important. Go ahead.
I'm talking too much.
No. Go ahead. I'll go after you.
I guess sometimes with like, one thing I know is like being in tune with your curation. And it's like, especially if you're putting together something that you realize it's important or you're invested in for whatever reason, rather you're really dealing with the audience, or like you're behind the scenes, but you're like dealing with the people, the artists that you invite to the curation, rather sonically or visually, it's a lot easier for you to like not just feel proud of your work, but feel like you accomplished your goal, seeing people having a good time, or like even like speaking with people. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes what happens is what people have is a burnout. It's like you're curating so much as it's not the same thing, but more so still battling the same barriers and curating so many different things. may get slightly jaded, and it's just kind of like you do just kind of like, let me just throw a show, let me just do this, let me just do that. And sometimes it's taking a step back and remembering what you're doing. It's yet again, the standard thing is like, okay, other than what I'm battling, everyone else had a good time. I met a couple of people here. I actually did get to speak with some of the guests, some of the other people. And then the fact that people enjoyed themselves or met new people is just like, that actually sometimes helps, because it allows you to know that you actually put something good together and it actually achieved its purpose, which was to bring people together.
Right.
Whether business that may come to that between you or them shows even more how it's needed, because now you're a space where people are comfortable actually exchanging ideas.
Right, right. I was just going to touch back. One other thing I'd really like to see from institutions is for them to stop making like one Black person the voice of, you know, everything. And I say that because I'm thinking back to a show I went to in New York this summer. I was like in shock. I didn't even know what to say. There was an artist that had put dirty towels that he had wiped his body down with up into frames and like over canvases. And that was the exhibition right in the front room. And he wasn't there, but this white curator told us that this was the result of his melanin wiping off onto the towels. So I stood there, I looked around, I'm like, are you serious? Is anybody going to say anything about this? And like, I brought it up, but yeah, that's what she legitimately like thought. And I don't know if the artist had told her this, but to me, it was just wild that like, she didn't have the presence of mind to go back and say, is this real? Is this accurate? And I don't know what his deal was, but like the fact that she didn't have, I don't know, the sense.
What?
Yeah, that's what I said. It didn't make any sense to me, but that was the exhibition. It was just dirty towels wiped off and that was his melanin. So I think, I don't know. Stupidity. It can't, if you're curating, especially like a New York City gallery, how do you let that slide? And how do you not do some sort of like looking into that? I was just in shock. So
I would be so interested to like know what was in the artist's mind. Like if that was like their context for like what the work meant to them, that is a whole other conversation. But like, okay. Wow.
I mean, from what I read from their statement, it really wasn't going deeper. It was like, and I feel like I lost a lot of respect for that artist after going through there, because I'm like, they really just like left it at that and gave this woman this information and she was dumb enough to like not read into it more. But I'm like, you have, to an extent, if you're doing an exhibition that has something to do with race, you have a responsibility to, you know, not just put any dumb thing out there. That's especially when there's curators and white people out there that will believe that and walk away with that and then spread that information
right
to other people. And I was in shock. I'm done.
Oh man. But I think like you really hit the nail on the head in terms of like the responsibility of, you know, the curator, the responsibility of the artist in terms of what you're putting out there, you know, lives in a certain context, and you have to be very mindful about what your work is contributing to the conversation and how that can be perceived by other people that, you know, may identify with you but come from a different experience or don't relate to their Blackness in the same way that you do. And like, how do you find that sort of like balance between, you know, being true to yourself and your artistry and what you want to convey, but also recognizing, you know, the responsibility that comes with that, especially, you know, where we're in the space where Black artists or Black curators are still being looked at as being the voice for everyone, all Black people, even though that's not accurate or fair or true, but the reality is we're still dealing with that, you know? And so you have to be very mindful about what you're putting out into the world. And that actually like makes me think about what we were talking in the earlier table. I had a couple of, there are a couple other artists, documentarian, a multidisciplinary artist and a professor. And we were just kind of talking about, you know, this idea of art history creating a very particular sort of narrative, right? This very linear idea of what constitutes art and like why it's so important that documentation, archival records that preserve, you know, the artist's intention, those are so important so that these ideas or these artworks are not co-opted to then signify something that's completely different than what the original intention sort of was.
I completely agree. I mean, if we look at like Walker's work out of context, like all the silhouettes, like I could see if there was no archive of that, you know, people would take something totally different.
Any
way. Yeah.
Okay, so this was one that came up in our people session. So I'm curious what folks think about this one. So how is cultural memory passed down to younger generations? Discuss legacy, intergenerational advocacy, and mentorship.
I feel like there's not a lot of that here in Buffalo. As far as like people just bringing up younger artists, I don't really see that a lot. And then I feel like a lot of people here really don't know the history of like Buffalo, like you know how great of a, you know, art culture we have here. But I could be wrong. That could be in the circles I hang in. I was in a lot of music circles. You guys might have, you know, different perspectives.
I think you know, from what I see about Buffalo, and you know, repetitively, is that Buffalo is really cliquey, and I think that eliminates the possibility of you know, reaching younger generations just because of just the way that it's set up. I don't honestly think that's really anyone's fault. I think that's just honestly just the way that the city is. The city is really like a neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood type of setup, where your neighborhood could be one street, you know what I'm saying? And then the next neighborhood is the next street, and y'all don't mix, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's really interesting in that way. I think there's a couple of initiatives that kind of are trying to, that are breaking through that. And just speaking to myself, right? Like, in us, right? Us being, you know, somewhat pioneers in what we do. You know, there's not many of you. There's not many of me, you know, and us, you know, taking on the hat of being the facilitators and being the ones who are bridging that gap between our age group and the next, you know what I'm saying? And I mean, I guess it kind of is, it's kind of speaks to our success and our resilience and, you know, us just not giving up, you know what I'm saying? On, you know, what we believing in ourselves. So I think that we're kind of turning that over a little bit. I think with social media kind of helps that too. You know, you get the visibility, and we, you know, our pulse is never really weakened. You know what I'm saying? Like, people still look at us. We still getting the looks from the young people, you know what I'm saying, and crossing over those generations. So I think that's kind of, I do think it's kind of changing. And I came from a family who was like really deep rooted in, you know, passing down culture memory. So I think it was kind of like something that I was born into, you know what I'm saying? Like, my family was like really strong in the Kwanzaa community. Like, I talk about all these things. I talk about the center and Langston Hughes and all of that. So I guess I kind of like was born into that. You too, you know what I'm saying? So I think it, you know, I don't know. Maybe you might not look at it because it's like your identity, like for real, you know what I'm saying? But I think that's definitely something to recognize for you within yourself, because I think we do that. We've been doing that, you know what I mean? Like, And I mean, art, when you're like really an artist, like, your stuff is going to transcend the now regardless. You know what I'm saying? It is, your existence is a legacy, You know what I'm saying? So I think that Buffalo is kind of shifting like that, just because like now we're like really emerging as, you know, like a hub of culture. You know what I'm saying? So I think that it kind of started, you know, and you know, getting exposed to like the teaching artist profession has been something that is like really cool. You know what I'm saying? I encourage y'all to kind of maybe break into that. You know what I'm saying? Because there's room, and that's an easy way to reach back and build on what you do in yourself. Like when I go into these workshops and these spaces, I don't look at it as me just teaching. It's a way for me to sharpen my own skills. It's a way for me to, you know, collaborate even, you know what I'm saying, with young minds while you're exposing them to certain things, you know what I'm saying? And then you add on the fact that these organizations, sometimes they be having a little bit of money. So you could build on your assets and build on, you know, how you could push the culture even further through, you know, your own goals and your own agenda, you know what I'm saying? I think that's one of the things that we really got to focus on, is like us really having an agenda for our culture. You know what I'm saying? And by all means, and whatever it takes, if we got to take from somebody, then we take it from somebody and putting it into what we believe in and pressing forward and us developing within our own cultural space. So I think I think, you know, that's definitely something to think about, but I think it's happening. I believe in it for sure. Like I've seen all of y'all get busy. I'm a fan of all of y'all. You know what I'm saying? So I'm an optimist though. So.
But we need that. We need that positive energy. And, you know, we need that acknowledgement that even if it sometimes doesn't feel like it, that we are, you know, moving forward from where our elders were, you know, all these years ago. And, you know, they've laid out a certain blueprint and have experienced certain shortcomings or mistakes that become opportunities for us to learn from and move past so that we don't repeat them. And with that, we can move forward, you know? And I think to your point, Rashad, like collaboration is so, and like community and collaboration is the future. It's the only way that we're gonna get anywhere where we are right now. And I think that sometimes with that, people have this idea that if we're collaborating, that we have to have the exact same vision. And like, that's not necessarily true. Like, I think there's a lot of power and opportunity in difference and having different perspectives, having different ideas, but then there's also power in respecting those differences while also celebrating the overlap that exists as well, you know? And I think sometimes just like reflecting back on, you know, past attempts at collaboration in this mass, like community mobilization, you know, I think getting caught up in whose vision is the vision to follow has been like a major shortcoming, when I think the conversation is more about how do we mutually respect each other's differences and allow the overlap that does exist to help propel us both, you know, 10 steps forward.
I liked a lot of what you said. And I think that we just have to constantly ask ourselves, what more can we do? And what new ways can we support each other? What better ways can we support each other? And just building better habits of doing so, and believing in each other, no matter what it is. I think with you know, at being artists, you get lost in your sauce. Like, that's so easy to do. And so easy to just put your head down and be focusing on what you're doing. But sometimes we got to look up and check in. You know, every time you see the possibility of, you know, an opportunity, pass it along. You know what I'm saying? Every time you see the opportunity to be able to support somebody, make sure you do. You know what I'm saying? And just building better habits with that instead of getting lost in it. You know, I've been a victim of that a lot of, you know, so many times. And just becoming more responsible and breaking out of that, I think is something that is going to push us forward. Again, you're not from here. So, you know, you weren't born into like the me versus him mentality that is very prevalent in Buffalo. But, you know, the more people see people coming together and being together and building with each other, I think the better that it's going to be, and challenging each other. You know what I'm saying? Like we got to keep challenging each other. If you see something that you think you can, you know, push somebody to be better in a certain space or whatever, do it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know I've been extremely outspoken, like, for as long as I can remember. And, you know, sometimes it may rub people the wrong way, but, you know, if you're not challenging people and getting, you know, trying to get them to be thinking about how they can be better, how we can be better, and how the collective can be better and us be better culturally, like, it's not going to happen. You know what I'm saying? You got to get uncomfortable sometimes too, you know, and have those uncomfortable conversations amongst ourselves. I know it's, you know, the times will tell us that we're supposed to be having uncomfortable conversations with white people, but we got to have uncomfortable conversations with ourselves too. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was kind of like what you were saying about community earlier, the whole idea of like people don't have to actually agree. I think we get caught with community. It's like everyone has to like each other, opposed to everyone needs to respect each other. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like maybe your mother doesn't like the woman down the street, but for whatever reason, because you're both neighbors or both parents with children, they know that if she's not home and you need to get somewhere, she's going to open up her home, because from mother to mother, they came to some conclusion that we need each other just in case, you know, something happens. Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, I don't need my kid just locked outside or whatever. Right. And it's like people forget that context, that people need to like each other, or people have to be friends with us. All those things can come in due time the more you get to know someone. But sometimes, as far as working with each other, we don't have to like each other. We don't have to necessarily be friends. We have to actually value and respect each other for what we're doing within our communities. What's our capacity and what's our given capacity, what we're deciding to do.
Right.
And like keeping that bigger picture, you know, kind of center, like Rashad, like I think you like said it perfectly in terms of getting lost in your own sauce, right? And just getting so caught up on where your trajectory is going as an individual, that sometimes the bigger picture of, you know, what you're hoping to contribute to bettering your community kind of gets lost. And then if someone does something that you don't like or doesn't agree with where you're trying to go as an artist, then that takes the focus away from what the ultimate goal sort of is. And then it gets into, you know, the egos and all of these extra things that take energy, time, focus, attention away from how coming together gets us further. Mm-hmm. So this is like a lot of work and effort and intention. So this question I think is a good one to kind of, I'm curious what you guys are thinking, but discuss strategies for maintaining your practice and your spiritual, physical, mental well-being as an artist or art worker.
I take many days off. I have some me time, you know, small trips. I like to take drives, but you definitely got to, you know, make sure that, you know, my mental is always right. And that's the main focus. And your health.
Mm-hmm.
Like, feel good.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing for me is,
go ahead.
I think one thing for me is having my no be in place and be ready for when I need to use it. I feel like, particularly as an artist, you're putting so much of yourself into your work, and so much of that is like can be personally draining. And there's definitely a time to be able to just say no to certain things. And, you know, even if it's not anything bad, it's just you might have given all you have to give within this span of time. And I think to protect your own well-being, sometimes you just have to be willing to say no. for things, which I hate doing because I want to do a little bit of everything, but.
I think I've been doing my best to make sure everything in my life is like aligned to contribute to my goals. And my practice is really like, I describe my practice as like a lifestyle practice. So I think like everything to a certain extent that is controllable should contribute in some type of way. Like most of my relationships contribute in some type of way for like these types of things, whether it be spiritual, physical well-being or mental stability, or directly related to contributing to my practice. And just making sure that I'm aligned, like everything is aligned. So things that, you know, if they're not completely removed explicitly, then they kind of just have tailed off, thankfully, because, you know, this is like really my life, and like my practice is really, you know, everything that is involved in my life, I want to contribute to my practice. So alignment has been another really important thing to aspire to. For my well-being, and yoga. I love yoga.
I feel like this is like not a great moment in life for me to answer this question, because life is in overdrive right now with school and work and all the things. But I guess for me, the best thing that I've been able to practice in the midst of all the chaos and all the things has just been really trying to be intentional about setting boundaries for myself in terms of allowing myself to rest and have a break, and, you know that work is not going nowhere. So if I just take this like couple of hours to just reset or recenter my mind, or just get myself feeling, you know, better physically, mentally, spiritually, whatever, that'll only make the work that I produce when I come back to it, you know, that much stronger. And like really unlearning this feeling that if I haven't, you know, shot, you know, any film or anything in a couple of weeks, or if I haven't done this, that means that I'm a fraud, or I'm not doing what I need to do, and I'm just falling off. Like giving myself more grace, you know, and understanding that I am a human and that I do need to rest, and I can't do it all at once right now, and that's okay. That doesn't make the work that I do any less valid when it comes later down the line. Ooh, but it's hard.
Do you guys have self-care plans?
Just trying to remember to eat every day.
Yes.
So
drink water.
So I don't know how this got introduced to me, but I was talking to my girlfriend the other day, and I thought it was kind of like a thing. Like people, you know, people have self-care practices, but someone once told me to write down my self-care plan, right? And I have like a list of things that kind of either put my mind at ease or are a method of self-care, whether it be like taking a bath, sketching or yoga, going for a walk, whatever. Or things that are simple day-to-day things like taking a hot shower or whatever, like that are part of my self-care plan, but it's literally physically written for me to refer to, like a list, you know what I'm saying? So just giving y'all a gem, if you will, I think that's been, especially since the pandemic, but even before that, like it's something that I have and that I, you know, updated, whatever. That's definitely something that has worked for me, not just as an artist, but as a person who wants to be okay.
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's a great idea.
Clicking through these cards. Do you guys have, well, of course, what describe your art communities. What are you guys' art communities like? I feel like we're all in different communities, right? What are your art communities like right now?
I mean, hip hop is in one of the greatest places that's ever been in Buffalo right now. But then, like we talked about earlier, there's not too many venues for the local artists to really, you know, showcase their work. So, I mean, we still make it work. We'll get up in somebody's basement, backyard, plug some speakers up and get it rocking. But to be able to even show some younger artists, you know, a bigger venue and how it's supposed to look, how it's supposed to sound, it would be very nice.
Well, I just want to say, as an elder in this community, you guys are so inspirational to me. It gives me really, really genuine and full hope that Black art has a future in Buffalo. And thank you all so much for what you're contributing.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you, Don. Rashad, what about you? What does your community look like? Your communities?
Well, I think that I've had a great experience building with youth. It's getting more and more vast, and I'm touching more and more people, and I think that it's growing in regards to the younger people. I'm getting a lot more exposure to younger minds and touching younger people. So that's been very cool to do. I think that scholastically there's been a little bit of a hindrance, but hopefully that's on the rebound now after the pandemic. I know that they're going to be doing a bigger show with Runway this year at Buff State. That is actually including, they're like, Aaron's been reaching out to more community partners and artists. I think Idris is even on board as a partner with the show. So that may be on the rebound, and I think that'll be pretty cool. I think that there's going to be an upside to fashion creatives in Buffalo too. I think that's on the up and up as well. A lot more commitment and people making the investment, mm-hmm. you know, into themselves and into their art form. So that's been good as a corner that people are turning coming out of the pandemic as well. So I think the fashion community is definitely moving forward, mm-hmm. for sure. And it, you know, it's being influenced by other art mediums too, whether it be music, fine arts, people, you know, dabbling into certain things. So I think the fashion community is definitely making some headway, some good spaces opening up, brand buildings at an all-time high, I would say too. So people definitely taking to the next level. I think that there's room for more community building and more like people coming together and building together. I think that's really the next step. I think like I've been paying a lot of attention to places like Chicago and like how a lot of the fashion creators from Chicago have like really taken it to the next level from that space. So I think that the formulas for Buffalo to kind of make some like big leaps are there, but I think it's going to take us really working together a lot more and utilize pooling our resources and really pushing for our culture. But hopefully in due time that can happen.
To piggyback what you're saying, Rashad, it's like within, I guess, the creative communities in Buffalo, we have everything that a lot of the cities need. Like you're mentioning Chicago, Philadelphia, it's like a Buffalo times 10 in a lot of their spaces, because I feel like there might have been like continuous support throughout the years and strong enough because it's more people. They're going, like, it looks like what we're doing here. And I just kind of like what you were saying, Brian, was like, it seems like it might be like a disconnect between people who have more resources, between those who are up and coming. But with our up and coming artists or people who are doing collaborations, collectives on lower levels, there's still a strong network that has been developing, and a strong network within independent or indie spaces within the city that has allowed the culture to grow. It's just now it's how to actually tap into these artists and actually really give them the platform they need. Because like as soon as that happens, we are going to be on par with any other city that has like a machine or an industry, or it makes it easier for people to really have a spotlight on what's really going on here. So it's not just people are putting funding into Buffalo, but they're putting funding into the artists and the communities and also the communities that come from, so they can actually build out more of the talent from those spaces, which will exceed just art, but like, okay, this artist from low income community, how can we increase the quality of life in the community he comes from? If one of these artists are here, then that should be several artists are from here. How can we find a way to like even pull our resources to that point?
Julia, what about
I hope y'all apply for the CRNY grant. Did y'all apply for that? Good.
I'm ineligible.
Best of luck with that.
Next time.
Yes. I think if we come through on the brighter side of that, it's going to be good for the community too.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be I think that would be like a breakthrough. That would be like a real shining moment, like the solid foundation that we need. That might be it. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm wishing the best for all of us who apply for that, for sure.
What did you guys order to eat?
I'm gonna get
I had a turkey, so
yes.
Yeah, Brothers. It was delicious.
Ooh, Brothers is real good.
I love Brothers. So I love Brothers so much.
For real.
I had noodles, so I haven't decided yet.
Yeah.
I'm probably doing mine after the call.
Yeah.
What do you guys have? We got a couple minutes, but what are you working on, or what do you guys have planned for like the rest of the year? Like what do you got? Is there any goals that you guys want to share?
I know at some point this year I'm supposed to go on Sway in the Morning with Skeez. That's one of the highlights I'm waiting for. But just kind of letting it go as it goes.
I'm ready for that.
I think for me, one of my goals is to really step fully into myself as an artist and put myself out there a little bit more. I feel like with curating and with, working at the Birchfield, like that trajectory has already kind of launched, and I feel like really good about where that's going. But then there's this other side of myself that I really want to express through my photography. And I have been like running away from it for so long that I'm like really excited to really step into that and see how that combined with my curatorial work will just like take me to the next stratosphere. So I'm kind of like excited about some projects that I'm working on for my thesis, really like channeling my inner Carrie Mae Weems and like really tapping into myself. And I haven't shared anything yet, but I'm excited to kind of get to that point where I'm ready to put it out into the world. So it's my goal.
Let's go.
I'm thinking about changing the world. I'm changing my career this year.
Ooh. What are you thinking?
I'm going from educator to DEIO, the DEI field. I realize a lot of the work I've been doing translates, so I'm just kind of like, why not? See what happens. I'm ready for a new adventure.
Make the change. Julia, what about you? What are you excited about?
I'm working on the show for Birchfield, so it's going to be that. And just being a good mom, I just had a baby, so I'm just focused on that. Thank you. And just, you know, getting through that first year and doing right by him.
How has that been with balancing artistry, you know, teaching artists, motherhood? How has that been for you?
It's crazy. I mean, it's changed everything. I had a show last night that opened over at BAM, and just thinking about the prep that went into going into that show leading up. I mean, I delivered in December, and as soon as I was able to get into my studio, I was just there until like 1 a.m. most nights, just, you know, and then trying to balance out being with him and switching off and everything.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's just changed the dynamic of things in a major way, as I imagine kids always do. But it's been beautiful. I mean, I already see just like this whole experience of entering motherhood affecting the work that I'm going to make down the road, and just like shifting, I don't know, maybe my perspective on some things too, and just like thinking about that role in his life.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Wow, congratulations again.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I've seen pictures on Facebook. He's adorable.
Thank you.
I don't think Rashad or Brian answered what their, or did you answer? You answered, Brian. You didn't answer, Rashad. You got 60 seconds.
I'm shifting studios now. I'm going to be looking to hopefully open up my full studio this year. You know, all encompassing for all of my goals and hit every, you know, everything that I set out to achieve, and just be as consistent as I can be with making clothes this year, I think is my main goal. I had a really good start to the year, so I just want to be consistent and really get back to what I love about fashion and making clothes, which is my best skill. You know what I'm saying? So stay there, I think, and be consistent. Consistency. Yes. Hope you guys stay consistent this year.
Yes, we will.
Pleasure, guys.
Pleasure. All right, I'm going to
stop. My little cousin Shaka said hey.
Hey.
What's up, Shaka?
All right, I'm going to stop.
What's up? What's up?